Well, I think there's supposed to be someone actually who's here and says, ready, set, go, but it doesn't look like there is. So I guess I'll just go.
Go ahead.
My name's Jim Smithson, and I appreciate you coming. Since some of you are my age, you remember back in the 60s, the anti-Vietnam slogan about what if they gave a war and nobody came? You know, anytime you give a presentation or volunteer, you always wonder, what if no one comes? So I appreciate you coming. If I glance down to my right, it's so I don't accidentally bump this thing and go tipping off the front of this stage. I want to talk a little bit about why the church works in certain kinds of places, not just in some places, but in specifically certain kinds of places, and why it doesn't in others. If Leo Tolstoy had been more interested in LDS wards than in Russian families, he might have written this sort of a line. All strong wards are strong in a similar way. Each weak ward is weak in its own way. It's not very literary. It probably doesn't sound any better in Russian. But nevertheless, I think it's a useful observation to at least start with. I want to focus on the way strong units are similar in terms of the places where they operate. And they tend to be in certain kinds of places. In this valley, the strong units tend to be on the East Bench, not the West Side. In the U.S., they tend to be in the suburbs, not in the inner cities. In the world, they tend to be in the global north, the developed countries, not in the south, in the less developed countries. There are some exceptions, but I think the rule still holds, the general pattern still holds, and I want to focus on the general pattern, not the exceptions, even though they're interesting in their own right. By strong wards, I mean strong in an objective, organizational way, on the kinds of measures that we send in reports. And that's going to be a theme that I come back to from time to time. Sacrament meeting attendance, Melchizedek priesthood holders, full tithe payers, etc. I don't mean the kind of subjective measures that are important to people, and maybe even more important to people than the objective measures. I like my ward, people are friendly, everyone's really nice, etc. I feel welcome there. We like to think that the strength of a ward is an expression of its spiritual quality. I'm going to argue that the strength of a ward, at least in terms of its objective measures, is much more mundane than that, and therefore it's a whole lot more problematic than that. I want to start off with a couple of concepts to illustrate the point and use it to introduce it. One is going to come from the liberation theology movement, and the other comes from global economic development. So first, liberation theology. The movement of liberation theology swept through Latin America in the 1950s and 60s. It was inspired, motivated primarily by the relationship between the Catholic Church and the wealthy classes in Latin America, and often to the disadvantage of the poorer classes. It was often called by critics Marxist Christianity. I always wondered if Marxists would think that would be humorous or insulting. But it was based very heavily on the notion of class interests and people operating in terms of their own class interests. I want to focus on one particular concept. It was a phrase coined by a Peruvian priest named Gustavo Gutierrez that he called a preferential option for the poor. There were two aspects. One was theological. That was the notion that Jesus, during his earthly ministry, had expressly focused on the needs of the poor. He hung around with the marginalized, the disenfranchised, and the poor. And ultimately, those are the people who would, in Jesus' words, inherit the kingdom of God. It also had a practical side to it, and that was what the movement was largely about. And that was that the church, the Catholic Church in this case, should focus intentionally and deliberately on the needs of the poor members in terms of how it spent its money, in terms of where it located its buildings, in terms of its choice of languages in which to hold meetings. For example, indigenous languages rather than Spanish, much less Latin. The key point is that all decisions needed to be made with a deliberate bias toward the poor. It wasn't an intent, there was not their intention to be unbiased, but rather to be intentionally biased and acknowledge that bias in favor of the poor. on the idea that they would be the people who would be least capable of adapting and adjusting, whereas the wealthy probably had the resources to make their own adaptations. If we use that sort of a lens of liberation theology to look at LDS, our church way of doing things, I would argue that we represent, or that we have a preferential option for the middle class in terms of the way we do things. We locate our meeting houses
just a little
closer. Okay. We like to locate our meeting houses, and especially our temples, in really nice areas where they're respectable and presentable. In terms of the times and the frequency of our meetings, we assume that people have cars, that they can easily access the meetings multiple times a week. As somebody who relies heavily on the bus, I can tell you that even here in Salt Lake, the Sunday bus schedule is not very friendly. My bus runs every hour and a half on Sunday, doesn't start running until about 9:30 and stops running at about 5. So if I had to rely on that to get to church meetings, I probably wouldn't get very far. We also, I think, in terms of our formal style of meeting, we have a preferential option for the middle class. It's comfortable to people who have grown up attending schools, working in organizations, participating in organizations that are fairly formal. We have, I think, a preference for the middle class in terms of our clothing, which is familiar and accessible and affordable for the middle class. Sometimes it's not so affordable, and it's certainly not so familiar to a lot of the working class people. Now, I don't want to make too big of a deal out of it, but I think one of the symbols of our difficulty operating as a church around the world is the white shirts. It's interesting that our so-called uniform of the priesthood is the same thing that is the origin of the term white collar. I think it's interesting that we have started to use, or maybe we've always used, the white shirt, even though we claim it's not required. It's sort of an informal sign of conversion. You've probably all heard the stories of someone who shows up at church in a white shirt and tie, and that's the real sign that they finally really converted to the gospel. Maybe they cut their, if it's a man, maybe he cut his ponytail too. I think white shirts also, in an interesting way, convey a false image of prosperity in the church. I think when our church leaders travel around the world and they meet with large groups of people, and most of the men are dressed in white shirts and ties and maybe even suits, I think it conveys an image that, hey, they're just like us. They're very similar to us. And therefore, if we all do things the same way, that makes a lot of sense. So why do we do things in a middle class way? Why do we have this preferential option for the middle class? One possibility is that we're intentionally biased, that poor people aren't worth the investment, that we don't get that much out of them. I'm not, even in my bad days, I'm not that cynical. So I think there's some better reasons than that. I think the better possibility is that we naturally favor the middle class in our ways of doing things, even if it's unintentional, for several reasons. One is that the designers of church programs are themselves middle class folks. I think that means they make some assumptions. They make assumptions that people have easy transportation, like they do. They make assumptions that people have discretionary time, weekends, like they do. I think they assume, as most of us who are educated and have worked and survived in formal organizations do, that the way to deal with almost any problem is by organizing it, by holding a meeting, by developing a program, by setting goals, by measuring and monitoring those goals. That's our natural solution to many problems. Number two, I think we also have a very strong desire to look respectable, not only in our buildings that I mentioned earlier, in the way we dress. We are very concerned about the way we present ourselves, and we like to do it in a very middle class and a very a nice way. Finally, I think we operate the church in a way that's very, very expensive. It costs a lot of money to build all the buildings, to produce all the materials, and to provide all of the oversight. And frankly, We need people with money in the church in order to pay for all of that. So whether we like to acknowledge it or not, I think we've come in the way we do church to depend on people who have money, and we have to pay attention to them. I think it's an uncomfortable fact, and I'd like to talk by the end of this about how that comes back to kind of bite us when we try to do some things around the world. The second example I want to use to start off with is global economic development. Roughly after World War II, the so-called developed countries that we used, the term we used at the time, made a concerted effort to help the less developed countries. The motives weren't entirely pure. It was partly a race to beat out the red menace before they spread around the rest of the world. It was partly an effort to open up markets to our own people. But the objective at the time was to let the so-called third world nations follow in the path of the developed countries. And that meant literally following in the same path of developing industry, developing infrastructure, and doing it on the sort of same scale and the same pattern. Now, after several years, after several decades, when people started looking back, they were realizing that a lot of projects were failing. A lot of these, even with the best of intentions. And there were a number of reasons. Probably the most famous is the corruption in some of the countries that received the aid. Those make the headlines. A little less well known is the self-serving contracts or the self-serving aid from our own country. For example, agricultural aid to deal with famine relief had to be purchased from U.S. companies, had to be transported by U.S. companies. By the time it was done, most of the money that had been allocated for aid actually went back into U.S. pockets. It didn't end up in the hands of the people who were supposed to receive it. But another reason people came to realize is that many of the projects were too big, too costly, and too complicated. They were very difficult for people to keep up with. And in the 1970s, there was sort of a rebuttal to that size and scale of development known as appropriate technology. The concept itself can be traced back to people like Gandhi, but it was popularized by the 1973 book by E.F. Schumacher called Small is Beautiful. In it, the new standard for technology that Schumacher and others sort of put forth is that it needed, of course, to be functional, to be useful, but it also had to fit the people it was supposed to serve. It needed to fit their resources, their conditions, their circumstances, their capabilities. Here's a simple example. A grand example, for example, if people needed to expand their irrigation system for their crops or for drinking water, might be a grand hydroelectric project, but I'll do something a little smaller than that. If I wanted to build a pump, I could have a couple of options. One would be the typical way, which would be a pump operated by, say, a gas or a diesel motor. It's very effective. People have been using it for a long time. Pumps a lot of water. But getting a motor to pump water, it's expensive to purchase the motor. It's expensive to provide the gasoline or the diesel to keep it running. It's expensive to get the parts to keep it running, and difficult to get those parts. Often in outlying areas, that became impossible. And you need people who have experience in order to repair and keep some of those machines running. So folks from the appropriate technology movement might argue that, say, a better example or a better possibility in some places might be to have a water pump that's powered by bicycle pedals. It could be also functional. It could pump water, but it would be inexpensive to purchase, to operate, and to maintain, and it would be easy to maintain if those people were used to riding bicycles and taking care of bicycles. The key point they were trying to argue is that the appropriateness of any technology could not be decided a priori. That is, it had to be decided with the people, the users, the end users in mind. It had to fit their resources and capacities. It had to fit their conditions. And by definition, that meant it varied from place to place, depending on people's circumstances and conditions. Now, if we use the appropriate technology lens to look at LDS churches, our local churches, in the same way we used liberation theology, I think we can see our own organization as a sort of social technology. And I think it's appropriate, or at least it's reasonable to ask, is it appropriate, or more clearly, under what conditions is it appropriate? I've argued before, and I think it's pretty clear, that we do church in a very formal way. We do church with schedules, with agendas, with defined roles, with hierarchies. We have lines of authority. We fit the definition of a bureaucracy very well. Even though we may make fun of bureaucracy and government, we've embraced it wholeheartedly in the church, it seems like. What sort of social technology, that sort of social technology, formal, very rigid, it fits certain experiences and certain people, but not others. It fits me. It probably fits you because you have experience with that. Since you've gone to school, since you've worked, since you've dealt with your with bureaucracies all your life. But it does not fit, or it may not fit, people who don't have that background and experience. People who have not had that kind of a situation in their lives. And in that sense, it goes against the rules of appropriate technology. It was designed by someone else who lives somewhere else, not by the people or for the people in the current conditions. It was imported rather than being designed to fit their conditions. The consequences, I think, are pretty obvious, that local participants can sometimes be uncomfortable or overwhelmed by the technology. The organization that is handed them is not sustainable locally. They don't have the organizational capacities. It has nothing to do with their spiritual commitment or their dedication. And I was afraid at this point that some people might think I'm saying that some people in some parts of the world don't have the wherewithal, say the mental capacity, to run a formal organization. And I wouldn't argue that at all. I would argue that someone who, say, an Australian Aboriginal who has the capacity to find water out in the middle of the outback has a lot of skills and has the absolute intelligence to operate in his or her own environment. It's just that perhaps he or she has not been exposed to that sort of environment before. So rather than go to reasons for the way for doing it that way, which will sound a whole lot like the reasons I just gave for on the previous example of liberation theology, let me ask you to do a new observation. I want you to picture in your minds the connection between an LDS ward and a minivan, or the new equivalent of a minivan, which is sort of the non-off-road suburban style SUV that has all the functions of a minivan but doesn't have the stigma. I would argue, and I think this would be an interesting, as a sociologist, I think this would be interesting to test. I would argue that there's a literal connection that we could call the law of the minivan. And it goes something like this. The performance of a particular ward is directly proportional to the number of minivans in the parking lot. I think it would be funny to try to work that out. I think there's also an allegorical connection, and that is that our church organization is a lot like a minivan, and that's the one I want to talk about for just a moment. There's nothing wrong with minivans. They're very popular. That's why we see them all over the place. They're perfectly good vehicles. They're even comfortable vehicles, but they fit certain kinds of situations. They fit populations that have the money to buy them and maintain them and use them. They fit settings where people have roads and have the infrastructure to support them, the garages and so forth. They do not fit other parts of the world where people don't have the resources, where the roads are dirt or non-existent, where there is not the support to maintain them and keep them running. And I would argue that much of the world, perhaps most of the world, falls into the second category. So the question we run into is, what happens to the church when it literally or figuratively gets to the end of the pavement? When it runs into places that are better suited for a Jeep or maybe a bicycle, depending on what their situation is. For the church, when we come to the end of the pavement, That means there are a lot of places we can't go. There are no roads. There's no power. There aren't property laws. There's not the infrastructure to support what we want to do. It means that in practice, there are a lot of rural villages, maybe inner city areas, where we can't or won't go. For people in those areas, there's an obvious result, and that is some people in the world, many people in the world, are not exposed to the church. Not because of their disinterest, not because of their moral shortcomings, but because the church can't or won't get to them. Over time, that limits where the church can, or it does, or it chooses to operate, and where it can operate sustainably. That creates a number of problems. I want to point out one paradox that it creates, and that would be a good topic for another time, another discussion. And that is that people who are most capable of running our kind of organization, that is the people with the minivans, the people with the white collars, the people with the experience, are probably least likely to actually join the church. Whereas the people least able to run our organizations, the folks on the bicycles, the folks who are day laborers, the folks who don't have a white shirt and tie, are probably more likely to actually join the church. Mark Twain, you've probably heard, once said that he had no respect for someone who can only come up with one way to spell a word. I've used that excuse many times. It usually falls on deaf ears when you use it with someone who can actually spell words. In the church, we have a deeper problem. We seem to only be able to come up with one way to organize a congregation. There is little, if any, local variation. There is little, if any, bottom-up adaptation. And in fact, we take pride in the uniformity. How many times have you heard someone returning from traveling and they bear their testimony at church and talk about how thrilled they were that when they were in Brazil or when they were in Indonesia or when they were in Tokyo, that they had the same priesthood or Relief Society lesson that they would have had if they'd been at home? That's really, really fantastic and kind of cool for the traveler. But I don't wonder if it's nearly as interesting or if it's nearly as great for the participants. We do have stopgap measures in the church. We have branches, we have basic units that people can sort of go with until they catch up. But everyone knows that that's not the real thing, and that's not where we're really supposed to stay. And my argument is that our one way of doing things has real consequences for people. That is, that our one way and our desire for uniformity actually take precedent over the needs and capacities of real people. I think, number one, that's bad theology, to have a preferential option for one group of people over another, not based on their spiritual qualities, but based on their temporal capacities. I also think it's bad technology, in the sense that I defined it, to have something that works only in certain kinds of places and doesn't work in others. Again, based on people's organizational experience and capacities, not based on their spiritual capacities. The Book of Mormon has a number of stories about how people were excluded from the churches because of their poor apparel or their poor appearance, and they were sometimes deliberately excluded. I don't think we would ever do that. That would be a little too blatant. But if we, however unintentionally, exclude people by the cost of participating and the complexity of participating, the result is the same. Usually when we look at the spread of the church worldwide, we look at two limiting factors. One, we look at the big picture. We look at political access to a country, whether we're allowed to be there and whether we're allowed to proselyte freely. Second, we tend to look at the very small personal level, whether people are personally prepared and receptive to our message. I think we miss the intermediate level. We miss the idea and the impact of organization and social structure that's between the big picture and the individual. I don't know that it's relatively more or less important than the other two, but I do feel strongly that number one, it's the one we think least about. As someone who tried really hard to teach social theory for a while, American students have a devil of a time catching on to the notion of social structure. It's interesting that students from Latin America and places like that catch on to it really quickly because they're aware of it and how it impacts their life. For American students, since most of us are well-schooled in the notion of individual success and performance, it's very, very hard to get, hard to see. But it's also the variable that we could do the most about because it's the one of our own doing. Whereas the political culture or the political situation in the country and the personal receptiveness of people, I don't know that we could do a whole lot about them. So for me, even though it's typically not on our radar, I would argue that our own organization, our complexity, and the cost of doing things the way we do is an important and perhaps the most important defining challenge for the global church. Thanks. So we don't have a respondent, so we could either talk amongst ourselves or we could go down to the student union. Alan.
A couple of things. You used the analogy of appropriate technology. There's another one that would complement that. 35 years ago, another concept was coming up. Amory Lovins in Energy talked about soft path versus hard path. And I think if you combine soft path notions that he developed and adapt them to complement the appropriate technology, looking at social organization as a soft path to, from the form we have, bureaucratic organization, to more flexible, adaptive, whatever. I wondered if you have any sense, when you talk about getting to the end of the pavement, whether you sense that there is an increasing understanding among the senior 15 that that is a problem, and that we need to look at more how to have organizations or non-organization or an alternative social forms for different cultural and even ecological settings, the poor and things like that. And do you have any sense of what's happening at the senior policy level and in understanding that so that over time that can filter down into the bureaucracy for implementation?
I think there's a recognition that the church organization, as it goes around the world, runs into places that it doesn't work. But I think that runs afoul of our notion of doing things the same way. I mean,
that's a fairly recent notion.
I think it is. And we are, of necessity, doing some things differently in other places. For example, we do things here in the U.S. that we just simply do not do around the world. We only do scouting in the U.S. now. We don't have church properties for girls or for scouting camps or for youth camps. Until recently, sort of extra things like seminaries and institutes have been pretty selective. The challenge is, and I think some of the brethren are probably aware of it, is it creates, in effect, a kind of a two-tier church. One church that sort of has all the goodies, has all the access, and another church that sort of has to make do with what they have. And organizationally, this isn't unique for the church, but I think an organizational kind of almost a law is that places that need programs the most often get them the least, and the places that need them the least get them the most. Around here, we already have a lot of support structures, say, for our youth. But we have all kinds of wonderful things that people in the rest of the world simply don't get. Whereas in other places in the world where you're the only kid in school or the only family in your neighborhood who's LDS, there's very little outside of regular church meeting. So I think there's a recognition among the brethren that that's a problem. I think it's obvious. I think it's obvious when they look at sort of the fiscal constraints of taking the church, the ideal church model, and taking it worldwide. But it honestly seems to me like they're not sure what the alternative would be. We want to do the church. We want to do church the right way. We want to do the real church, and that means the way we do it here. Yeah.
Can you give me an example of an urban setting where the present structure of the church does not work?
Repeat the question for the recording.
Okay. An example of an urban setting where the current structure of the church doesn't work. It's very common. Go ahead.
Go ahead and answer. I can think of a place, but go ahead. I'll follow up after you.
Okay. A very common way, for example, of dividing up units in urban areas to sort of do the pie model, where you have units that their boundaries radiate out from the middle of the city. So a lot of the converts come from the middle part of the city, but most of the leadership is in the suburban part of the city. Also, the chapel tends to be in the urban, in the suburbs. And everything's sort of built for people to go into the city, where we sort of emphasize people coming out of the city, going out to the chapel, going out to the temple, going out. So, for example, I remember talking with some kids in downtown Washington, D.C., some youth who had joined the church, and they would have given anything to be able to get together with their buddies and play basketball, just to get off the streets to do it. But the only chapel that had a basketball court in it wasn't their little rented facility in downtown D.C. It was the nice suburban chapel out in the suburb, out way too far away for them to get to.
Thank you.
I would second that. You're describing exactly the problems that when I lived in Houston, I worked with the inner city branch because, you know, I was in the suburbs and white, so I was excellent for leadership, except for my gender. But we had exactly these kinds of problems, and I had a roommate at the time who had actually worked in the same branch before me, as she'd been asked to go over there as well. And during the time that she was there, the inner city branch met in the ghetto area, and it was bursting at the seams with attendance. But it was one of these deals where they had a rented place and all of that. Well, anyway, then I think partly is in response to this, in an effort to say we're not, you know, prejudicing. We want to give everything to the people living there, as everyone else has. They moved the ward to a ward. They moved the branch to a ward house in the suburbs. And the membership went down almost to, like, maybe we were lucky to get, like, 8 people in sacrament meeting that were not assigned to be there from other units. And I spent most of my Sunday going around picking people up and dropping them off. And we were getting so desperate that, you know, we asked the church to buy a bus to round people up, and the church would not approve that, and all of these things. And I was the primary president. Well, that really means I just babysat. Because every week, there's a different set of kids, and they hadn't been there the week before, and they didn't know anything about primary, and they didn't know the songs, and you could try to teach it, but next week, you'd have a different set of kids, so you couldn't build one week to the next, and then this issue of the basketball was, I mean, that sounds a little stereotypical, but that's a very real thing. We could bring in teenagers to do almost anything from that area if we let them play basketball on that gym floor, that beautiful gym floor afterwards. And that's how we did a lot of things, was said, want to come play basketball? Okay. We'll have a little lesson and then we'll play basketball. Yeah. And it worked rather well if you don't mind driving around all day, and if you don't mind that next week it might be somebody different. And it was a lot of problems, and I really think you've hit on some really important points here that are, I hope you publish this somewhere, because I think it's vital.
It's amazing how many successful urban churches run pretty extensive bus routes in order to kind of sustain their urban membership.
Yeah.
And some people sort of look down on that as it's sort of a backdoor way of getting people to come to church. But for a lot of people, if they're going to come, that's the only realistic way they're going to come.
Those are the options, yeah.
Back doors are better than no doors.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question to what I've just heard, and then I'll make a comment. May I ask if this problem you describe is unique to the Mormon experience, or would all the Texas churches of any faith face various equal to similar details that I've just heard from you?
My impression is that a lot of the really successful churches in the world today, one of their strategies for success is that they have jettisoned a lot of their overhead and simplified what they do. And therefore, setting up shop almost anywhere is, you need a living room and a Bible. And that's been a very deliberate effort, whether it's the home churches in Asia or whether it's the kind of storefront churches in urban areas.
Because this example, while it's very good, it seems like an extracurricular part of church. It's the church acting as YMCA when you have a basketball program.
Mm-hmm.
The community obviously needs it, mm-hmm. and in this example given, a great effort was put forth to have a great after-school program for the youth. And I want to encourage that, but it's that church. A follow-up comment, I heard recently that the Adventist Church has grown rapidly in the last 5 or so years because they have radically honed off some of the things that they have expected of church members. White shirt, tie, schedules, you know, and meeting on a sandy beach of flip-flops for church service is an appropriate venue for them, if that's your culture in your space.
My impression is that the Adventists have done, they very deliberately set up a very decentralized structure. For as probably on paper as many members as we have, but probably in the pews more members worldwide than we have. The headquarters for the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a little 2 or 3 story building in outside of Washington, D.C. It's very inconspicuous. And so, yeah, apparently they have localized their decision-making, and that makes those local adaptations a whole lot easier.
Let me address two things about that a little more. One, organizationally, our church is different from others. We restrict the size of a congregation, which other denominations don't do. So we don't have mega churches. We have 200-300 member wards and then divide, which has some consequences for outreach in terms of if you got a mega church, you can have lots of buses. Another thing is that we have territorial boundaries. You go to the ward to which you're assigned geographically. That's not true of other denominations. So you can go from anywhere to that denomination. So those are some pretty important organizational differences
That's
that
true.
Affect what we're talking about. Another element is that, on the one hand, you were talking about the little home-based meeting, or, on the other hand, a megachurch. The limitation with the application to the Mormon or to the Restoration is that the Restoration intended to be a whole community. So that basketball is not just an auxiliary. It's part of making a whole Zion community. Not that we do it perfectly, but the intent is to design a whole society, not just have a shared belief system that we study the Bible together and talk about that, then we go off. So those are some fundamental structural differences.
There's a comment back there.
I think it was in 2008 at the Mormon Historical Association Conference, the Tanner Lecture, for those that aren't familiar, every year the Historical Association has a scholar who's not Mormon, who doesn't do Mormon studies, but who's top in their field, do Mormon studies for a year, so they kind of incorporate Mormon studies. I can't remember the name of the guy. It was the year it was in Sacramento. But he talked about, he studied Christian religions in Africa. And so he studied the growth of Mormonism in Africa. And he came to the conclusion, kind of the same problems that you have, that the church is growing great in Africa, but it's growing the same rate as all the other churches in Africa that are growing, kind of thing. And our theology fits a lot better with African ideas, you know, the way they think, and kind of the theology that they have in their culture. And we should be growing a lot more, but the problem is we don't let, what he said, we don't let Africans be Africans. You know, for them, they feel the spirit by beating the drum. And, you know, they don't feel it when it's silent. But the American culture that we have is in this table, you know, and...
Well, or a practical example. The church grew up in speaking of Africa, in Ghana, the church grew up in a small city on the coast called Cape Coast. That's where we sort of started from. But the church really wants to be centrally located and be urban. And so all of our offices and all of our focus is on Accra, the capital. So it's sort of where the members really were versus where we wanted to be.
Do you see any of your studies, members like in Africa, for example, do they realize how, you know, blessed, I mean, say the saints are in America, like they're living in a nice house versus they're living in a very primitive structure? Is there any of that recognition that there's quite a big economical differentials between the developed saints versus, you know, the developing world? Is that... they realize that they may not have as much access to internet, but I'm just wondering how that plays into, you know, we're supposed to be this one people, that's some of the quality, but there's greatly inequality in the worldwide church.
Yeah, and I think a good analogy is the role that the internet played in bringing down the Soviet Union, and a lot of the sort of propaganda that people had received when they started getting access to the outside world, they realized it wasn't true. It's amazing how much the internet has penetrated the world. Even in the most out-of-the-way place, you can find somebody who's set up a little cafe somewhere with a line or two that goes out. And I think especially for the kids worldwide who are more tech-savvy, I think they're pretty aware that how different things are for them. How our kids have access to EFY, how they have access to BYU, how they have access to an institute, and those kids don't have access to it. And I don't sense that there's this sort of, you know, seething revolution about to explode, but I think kids are aware of it, and I think there is, I worry when talking about that sort of two-tiered notion of the church, you know, the minivan church versus the bicycle church. I think people are pretty aware of that.
And how does the church cope with that? Do they just say it's kind of like a case system, God, this is your trial in life? And
I think the church copes with it by doing the same thing that the development experts did starting after the war. I think there is a sort of the myth that everyone's going to follow along the path of development and pretty soon they're going to catch up with us.
Using the same path.
Using the exact same path. Yeah.
You mentioned disparity between those that have and those that haven't. There was a presentation made here in Sunstone either last year or the year before where there are LDS children who are starving to death. And yet, the church reportedly, now I have no facts here, I'm just going on what I was told, will not send fast offering money from North America to those places where these children are starving. Now that is what I call disparity, and where the system is beyond basketball or whether they have a meeting house. I mean, when we're not able to feed children in our own church, it's just, if that's true, and I honestly don't know whether I believe it or not, to be honest with you, but that just bowls me over.
Yeah, Brigham Young's famous line about you have to feed a man before you can teach him the gospel.
Well, he's already converted to the gospel, and we're not willing, according to these people, to feed
his
children.
And now he's too hungry to get to church.
Yeah.
I don't believe that, because I know too many counterexamples. And I know, the person who was director of all the distribution of welfare stuff for the church, and he had no limitation like that in the presiding bishopric's office.
Yep.
I never heard such a thing, and I don't believe it.
Well, there is an article in Dialogue that details the fact. Now, so-called facts.
Details his claim. It doesn't.
Did you read all that by Brad?
No, I didn't read it, but I know the person in charge of the distribution, worldwide distribution for the church, and I simply don't believe it. Because the church, I mean, I know the church is given. I know a person in Southern Sudan, has received millions from the church that the church has given to Catholic Relief to help, because it couldn't do it directly, help with the refugees in Southern Sudan.
But are you confusing now humanitarian money with church money?
No, I'm saying that they come out of the same office in the church, in the welfare division.
Now, just a disclaimer. I grew up most of my life on or around the Navajo Reservation, and down there it was impolite to point, and so people would point with their chin. So if I don't point at you and I just sort of nod at you or point at you with my chin, that would be the same thing. Go ahead.
Church organization denies fast offerings, my thing would go back to your idea about the system. I live in an inner city ward in Philadelphia, and I would say a huge portion of the people who've been baptized into the church, who are no longer active because they don't last long, but those who have been baptized in have no idea we have a welfare system. So they may be starving and they don't know that we have a welfare system that they can tap into because they've never been really taught about it. And the flow of convert and disappearance in our ward is very rapid. So I could say that could support your claim, that it's not the Salt Lake denying funds, it's that somebody who's a baptized member doesn't know that is even available.
Well, in addition, a bishop who's been a member for 6 months or a
May
year doesn't
know. Mm-hmm.
And he's got 500 people, mm-hmm. 50 of whom are active.
Yeah, we have over 700 people on our list.
And I would also say that bishops and other local leaders have been routinely praised for their ability to be a good self-reliant unit, and that is to not tap into those other mm-hmm. funds. And so I think, with all the best intentions, local leaders are sometimes reluctant to ask for the kind of aid that maybe really is available to them.
Do you see the church in the 60s and 70s, I guess the cement in the 80s, correlation with doctrinal issues and everything else, do you see somewhat like a pulse correlation with respect to anthropology, where you're talking about the African states could start using drums in their sacrament meetings, where we go away from this kind of this American corporate model where doctrinally wise we stay this correlated model, but culturally we kind of allow some flexibility? Do you see the church kind of hiring more cultural anthropologists, or we just stay on this more American realistic model?
I think I think there are a couple of things working against the church doing that. One is, as Alan mentioned, the sort of, we feel like we really do need to offer a real breadth of experiences for people. And so a very simple, one way to adapt things into different circumstances is to simplify them. And I think that would be very, very difficult. I think we ideologically really want to have a unified system and a unified church experience. I think there are some things that would kind of run against that. On the other hand, I sometimes feel like unless we figure out a way to do that, that we're going to sort of, again, to use the sort of Soviet example, that we're going to sort of grind to a halt under the weight of our own overhead.
Or the end will come before we screw it all up.
Jesus,
that's hard. Is that to me?
Yeah.
Chins
are a lot less.
Our own doctrine says that the gospel will go to every kindred, tongue, and people. So in order to accomplish that efficiently, we as a church need to look at our. We need to look in the black box of Mormonism and decide what pieces of that are important to represent the gospel, and only disseminate those pieces to the far reaches, and not expect that IBM businessman look to be copied in, to take your example, you know, the outback of Australia to the Aborigines. That's metaphorical as well as literal. And so we need to identify what is it about our church, our the Mormon experience, that one must have and believe and apply on a typical Sunday to be a Mormon. Mm-hmm. Do you know if the general authorities have ever whittled that down to its bare bones?
Boy, I think my impression is you'd have a hard time getting people to all agree on what that short list is. But I mean, it's an interesting, I think it's a real question. I have a friend who once, on this topic, had this image, which I really liked. He said that, imagine the church trying to go into a new country, and we're still standing at the customs office trying to get our 24 crates of things through customs, where the couple of Pentecostal dudes with shorts and hiking boots, they already got off the plane. They've got each got a backpack full of Bibles, and they're already out of the airport, and they've already hit the streets. And clearly, the sort of evangelical Pentecostal model that has really, really been successful, it's largely been because they've stripped things down to if you have a group of people and a Bible, that's all you need.
Okay. Why can't we make those two ordained elders?
Or at least
they become our model of ordained elders. No polyester suits, no ties, no white shirts. They have hiking boots on, like backpackers, just like you described. If not, why not?
Men would be a good reason I would answer.
What is?
15 men would be
nice. Alan?
I don't think it's the 15 men. The 15 men preach a very simple, unified message that are the essentials, called the first principles of the gospel. The problem is the delivery mechanism called the church. That when we convert people, there's a whole delivery mechanism for baptism, for meetings, for collecting tithing, for distributing welfare, and all sorts of things. So we have whittled down the essentials of the gospel. I guess you're really getting at, and what may not have happened yet, is what do we consider the bare essentials of the delivery mechanism? And we've got to separate those kind, because it's the delivery mechanism that is the organization of the culture.
And in my mind, if we really do have, which I think we do, if we have sort of a minivan church in some places and a bicycle church in other places, the only way in my mind I can reconcile those is that they're going to have to somehow meet in the middle, which means that those of us who are around here who are used to having a pretty extravagant church experience would probably have to be willing to tone that down quite a bit. And I wonder how that would go over.
think with a lot of the tithing revenue comes from America, particularly Utah. And so when, you know, you're as a theater, you did that, and people feel like they potentially gain less value for the revenue they put into it. Because in many cases, they pay 10% gross or net. That's probably 90% of discretionary income expended. So the church becomes their social thing where I think there would be resentment. It's like, hey, I'm giving you all my discretionary income and then some, and now you're taking it back. So I wonder if that's why the church kind of has this two- or three-tier system, because they know where their cash revenue is coming from.
Mm-hmm. And I think there is a sense, whether it's explicit or not, that for every new building you build in West Africa or in Venezuela, you better, or for every new convert you have there, you better be able to balance it with some new people here who can kind of bankroll that.
Don't members throughout the country, at least, hopefully throughout the world, know that if the membership rates increase, then they too will have a new beautiful stake center with a basketball court in, to draw from their example? Or do they really see a disconnect? They look at the Salt Lake City Church and they look at its vast resources and they look at their little place in the world that has small resources. Do they also correlate with memberships and densities when they make that comparison? Because the argument could be made that per capita, we give more resources to these rural areas on a per capita basis than we do in the parts of the Wasatch Front that have a stake center with a basketball court, a hop, skip, and a jump away.
Yeah.
But which they are sharing with four other units, perhaps.
In the Wasatch Front.
Yeah.
You know, a typical three-ward building.
Now, and I do think that the way we do things here in terms of what our buildings look like or what our temples look like and what our curriculum looks like, that's the ideal that most people who come into the church aspire to. Go back to the same analogy, but I think it really is that sort of 1950s, 1960s development model where if you come, if you're faithful, if you're dedicated, someday you too will have all that. You'll have a basketball court.
Yes.
You'll have a girls' camp. You'll have
a welfare system,
a bishop's storehouse, whatever.
I realize my example is anecdotal, but my church mission was a hop skip from Papua New Guinea. And the branches, we're talking about small islands that make Hawaii look like a continent. And the resources dedicated to those branches was very generous on a per capita basis.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, the buildings were simple construction, tin roofs, plywood walls, but they had resources, basketball, outdoors, and things that was there. I mean, we're talking about islands that were on a generator for 2-3 hours a day.
Mm.
But as a comparison to how the rest of the island lived, the Mormon branches had a lot of resources.
Yeah, I think, and again, with good intentions, I think we would like our building to be the nicest, if one of the nicest, if not the nicest, kind of building in the area. We would like to see that as a kind of a beacon that attracts people. And part of that is because, I mean, we want to be seen as a church that's worth being a part of. That's it. Democracy in action, we made it without a leader. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Not just for democracy.